podcast about the 69th best show of the 21st century. I am one of your hosts, Ian, here as always with...
Ryan Swin, hello. And as you might surmise, this is a bit of an unusual episode. Unfortunately, while I was exporting my files, I accidentally deleted my end of the recording. Obviously, this is probably close to half of what you would hear in a regular conversation that we would have on the podcast. But I've decided that because Ian, his characteristic amount of strong insights, and I think that the conversation we had was really quite good, I've decided to edit together all of his times of speaking and cut out all of my silences where I was speaking. I know this might be a strange listen and it might be sort of difficult to follow at times, but think of it as a sort of experimental episode while we contend with the forces of the deep state, as Ian alluded to on our Twitter account. So I hope that this is listenable, but thank you for sticking with us through these technical difficulties and with this shorter episode, and I hope you enjoy.
And today we're talking about the hours from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. We're coming on night, and things are starting to heat up again. But before we get to that, I would be remiss in my duties if I did not ask you, Ryan, how was the intimate evening with Kiefer Sutherland? And he's got the beard going on now, right? Yeah, that's a good look. Yeah, that's actually I wanna apologize to everybody because I leaked to Variety there was going to be a new David Lynch film, but I accidentally confused Tarek Sela and David Lynch, which happens sometimes. I'm very bad with names, so I apologize for that. My information was correct. I got things a little bit backwards. But for those of you who maybe don't have the context, we've covered some of Kiefer Sutherland's music before, and as part of kind of like a, I guess a kind of U.S. tour, he played a small selection of dates across the country, and ended up in LA where Ryan was able to go see him. And it, from the videos and like description that you sent me, it was almost like a Springsteen on Broadway kind of thing. Like, he's kind of like telling stories along with the songs, right? Like a little bit. That's great. Yeah, they filmed it in Toronto. And that's, he's talked about it a little bit in interviews around the album, because like that was the first time he'd spent significant time in Toronto since his adolescence. So like that was the original inspiration for Bloor Street. Yeah, you got some souvenirs, right? Oh my god, you got a t-shirt. That's so good. Oh wow. And that, oh, that's fantastic. Oh man, it's like a tour t-shirt. That's great. Oh wow. That's fantastic. Oh, that's a great, yeah, I haven't seen the back cover. That's great. Wow. Well, as I said, I'm extremely jealous, but I'm just thrilled that you were able to experience that, especially knowing that it's like your first real like concert that you've gone to like of your own volition. That's so great. That's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, we'll definitely return to that experience when we maybe talk about his other albums. I think it's a little bit I think it's a little bit indicative of the kind of maybe turn he's taking in his career to like a more, like in interviews and stuff lately, he seems to have, you know, more of an introspective, like, I think he's a pretty earnest guy, or like he comes across that way at least, especially on the music side. But in that, that GQ interview was really interesting just to kind of hear him reflecting on his career and like where he's at now. So hopefully we see him in movies more. I'd love to get movie Kiefer back. So hopefully that's what happens.
Ryan here again. I'll be probably popping in briefly just to contextualize some of the conversations, especially for the discussion of 24 itself. Here I made a transition between Ian talking about movie Kiefer to how movie Kiefer gets some good moments in the ending of the second episode.
Yeah, that was a great transition, by the way. You really, That was a deft hand right there. That comes from years of podcasting. I did note while watching these two episodes together that, you know, even with the real-time conceit, I do think the show generally tries to adhere to the sort of like internal logic of an episode a lot more than maybe I expected. And maybe that changes as it goes on, but, I really felt like these two episodes together form this kind of like, yeah, almost like a mini film, because you have this kind of thread of like Detective Jack Bauer, right? And like this almost like a buddy cop movie with him and Mason. it's so good. Like it's such like the Jack stuff, it kind of goes without saying is usually the strongest stuff in the show, but these two episodes, the Jack plot is especially good. I love also, like, okay, so probably this is just maybe it's just a convention of television, or through the strictures of like screen time and dialogue and all of this, but I really do believe George Mason is a guy that drives his car in complete silence. Like no radio, no music. My man is like honed in on the road. Zero distractions. Those shades are so good. Yeah, and then, you know, one of the maybe like ill-fitting things about watching this back to back is like, yeah, we go from like 6:59 and 59 seconds to 7 p.m. and 1 second, and it's like all of a sudden completely dark out. Yeah, I'm like willing to believe that different characters in different locations are experiencing different light, but I think I also wouldn't have noticed it as much if we didn't get that really great dramatic shot of Jack and then Mason against the sunset right at the end of that episode. Like it's just like it's a sort of rare cinematic moment outside of the Stephen Hopkins episodes. So shouts out to Frederick King Keller, who really, really I felt brought something to the table in this episode. But yeah, then all of a sudden it's just like, it's nighttime, but it's like that weird TV nighttime where the actors still have to be like really fully lit. Even though there's no real like environmental light source anywhere. Yeah, I wanted to see, what I really wanted to see is like a day for night shoot, you know, like in Mad Max Fury Road with like the blue tinting. that's what I wanted. Oh yeah. It's the it's not the penultimate. I think he's still got two more, including the finale. So
here, I think I was talking about how George Mason conceals his phone call with Nina by just effortlessly making up this sort of patter about regular CTU stuff.
It's so great. He's just such a great foil for Jack. I'm impressed by the, like, because this is not really a show that thrives on, you know, interpersonal relationships. And these two really have not shared a ton of screen time. But it's just like the sort of like, I guess in some sense, the kind of stock types that they're somewhat filling just like go so well together, that it's really refreshing to have that. I guess it's like a kind of humor that's going on for sure. Mason's kind of like sardonic and sort of, but also, you know, at this point has kind of a begrudging respect for Jack, like that exchange where Jack apologizes for tranking him earlier, and Mason kind of, you know, sort of sarcastically responds. That's like a great moment. Or like one of the good little moments. He's like, I gotta tell you, Jack, it never gets dull with you. It's getting dull. Yeah, it's so great. And then when he gets back to CTU, and Dina's like, "Where's Jack?" And he's just like, "I don't know, he's wandering around in a field somewhere." Like, I think a little bit Nina's asking because she's like, maybe he killed him. maybe we left those two alone for too long and he finally snapped. It's just a great little thread that this follows for a little bit. Though I agree with you that, like, I mean, to me, that's a whole show. Like, that's a whole different version of the show that they could have done. Like, this is season one. This is still very much, like, a sort of amoebic type state for the show. And these two episodes are like, wow, what if this did become, like, the George Mason, Jack Bauer kind of, like... of course, he sticks around, which is great, and I'm looking forward to future seasons, but... it's just especially since I think we both agreed that the last set of episodes was a bit of a lull. I really felt like the show comes back to life here.
Here, I think I was comparing the scene where Jack and Mason are just strolling through the woods and looking at this utility box or bunker. I compared it to the scene in Black Hat Work where Chris Hemsworth and Tung Wei are looking at the water pumps in the desert.
Yeah, it reminded me... a little bit called back to, like, Fire Walk With Me, right? I thought of that as well. Because it's sort of weird, you know, Kiefer spent a lot of time on TV, but he comes along sort of at the, like, had he gotten into TV in the 90s, right? Like, he would have been on some kind of cop show like this, unquestionably. We maybe don't want to get ahead of ourselves too much on where that plot goes in the next episode, but just really solid. I thought it was really solid setup. And of course it delivers at the end as well. So I think that they're on their way back the best thing we can say about the Terry stuff is that it's moved to a new phase. Well, and actually I do a little bit want to praise two things. One is that we get that just fantastic moment of Tony busting in. Like, we get to see Tony Almeida in action. That rocked. I actually do also really like the sort of, I guess it's almost like a gag in a way, even though it's played straight, when they get to the house and the alarm goes off. Yeah, yeah. Well, he does eventually. I don't remember what happens with him, but I did think it was like in a sense, like, so much about this plot is so just out there, very, you know, very leaning into the soap opera thing. But, you know, getting home and it's like, okay, well, under the precondition that she does have amnesia, obviously this is like a problem, right? The alarm's going to go off, the cops come. Like, I thought it was just like a kind of a nifty little like thriller device that they were using to kind of extend this tension, right?
Here I talked about how it was totally ludicrous that the cops would show up less than a minute after the warning call was given for the alarm.
No, absolutely not. They're far too busy selling drugs as part of the Rampart scandal, killing, you know, Biggie Smalls, those kinds of things that the LAPD is known for. Allegedly. Two of them show up, like, right away.
Here I talked about the enormous amount of photos in the Bauer living room of just their family, and also the fact that Jack Bauer's military photo is a picture of Kiefer from A Few Good Men.
There's so many. Yes, yeah, that's a great little touch. A little bit of trivia there.
And here I talked about the possibility of Sorkin watching 24.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel like he seems like a guy who really liked the torture seasons. They do. There's some walk and talk going on in this show. I feel like he could appreciate that.
Here I talked about the sort of vague alt indie rock that was playing during the scenes, especially where Terry was told by her surgeon friend that music could jog her memory, and it's just this sort of lame music that was playing on Kim's stereo. during this supposedly heartfelt scene.
It's the dead zone culturally that this takes place in, right? Where it's like the writer's room is not cool enough to like know like the Strokes. But they're also not cool enough to like have their characters listening to like nu metal either. So it's just like this bizarre in between like alt rock that no one remembers. Not even the people who made it remember it anymore. Yeah, that was very funny. And also just like it feels like a product of like, okay, what can we actually afford? Like what songs can we afford to put on the show? Or I don't know, maybe it's like a producer's nephew's band or something. I don't know how these things work. But yes, we do finally like get out of that. And nothing really, not a lot happens with that in the next episode, right? It's just like them heading back to CTU, basically.
Here we talked about the Kim plot and Elisha Cuthbert.
Yeah, I think like at this point, the thing I would say is that she's doing the absolute most she can do with the hand she's been dealt.
Here I mentioned two lines. One is Rick talking to Dan's brother, saying that he wouldn't have gone back if he knew that the money wasn't coming, which is a very good question for him to ask. And the second was Kim saying that wanted to go to Rick's place to look for information that might have led her to find her mother. And she says that it was obviously a dumb idea, which is also
yeah. True. I forgot about that. That's so good. Yeah, I was going to ask you, because, you know, my memory's not the greatest. We haven't, it hasn't come up at all what, like, Terry does, right? Yeah, I wonder, you know, because, like, what I'm wondering is, like, okay, so it seems like it's sort of a, she's in the midst of, like, turning a hobby into, like, a business of some kind. And this brings up all kinds of questions, like, how long were her and Jack separated? Like, what was going on? Like, a lot of questions that the show just kind of, like, brushes aside a little bit. I don't know how important they are, but all of a sudden when it's like, oh, this is what she does, I'm like, actually, I think that's the first time I ever could have said anything about who this character is outside of this very specific situation that she's in. Like, we know nothing about her.
Here I talked about how, according to findings at CTU, Terry obtained her BA in painting from RISD and got an MFA in art practice from UC Berkeley, and how the first place that she worked was as a restorative assistant at the Uffizi, of all places, in Florence, and how she's also worked for the Santa Monica Gallery and LACMA and MoCA in Los Angeles.
I wonder if she was at RISD at the same time as David Byrne of Talking Heads fame. I think that's where all the band members of Talking Heads met. Yeah, I wonder. I'll have to do more investigation into the timeline there. Yeah, I mean, there's some questions here about the logistics and competence of the Serbian operators, for sure. That also come up in the next episode. But so, like, that gets resolved, but what doesn't get resolved is Kim's storyline. Yeah, you know, sometimes when you're in the writer's room and you're just like, we have to string together a 3-minute scene. You know, this is like a Freudian slip, right? All of a sudden, all the questions you should have been asking a few episodes ago become crystal clear to you. I don't know if it's made better or worse by the fact that the whole thing is like an LAPD sting operation. I can't decide, because that moment, you know, it's obviously meant to be kind of like a curveball twist a little bit. And I was like, on the one hand, I'm glad this phase of this plot is over. On the other hand, that seems like such a like cheater's way of getting out of this.
Here I talked about the cheesiness of the undercover cop saying you have the right to remain silent and how it did work for me on a purely humorous level, and also how the cop looks vaguely like Brad Dourif.
Yeah. Oh, well, and that hair, too.
And here I compared the sting to the scene in Euphoria where the kid gets shot after taking down a bunch of police officers.
Oh, yeah, like the viral clip that went around. And everybody was like, wait, I thought this show was about high schoolers. Yeah, it does have that energy. 24 is definitely a precursor to Euphoria in the way that it's like obviously written by someone who has no idea what young people are like. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think at this point, the writers have just decided that the easiest way to, you know, swallow this pill is to just write Kim as the dumbest person on the planet. And then she gets, like, Alex, so the cops bring him in, blah, blah, blah. And then she's, like, ranting and raving about her dad. I love it when she's like, my dad is Jack Bauer. Like, they're supposed to know. And then we get, of course, another great moment of someone else not knowing what the hell CTU is. Like, counter-terrorist unit, ever heard of it? Can't say as I have, you know? Yeah, well, you know, this is pre-9/11, and as everybody knows, you know, the problem that gave rise to 9/11 is that these agencies don't talk to each other. So as the writers were working on this, you know, this kind of running gag took on a new sort of weight to it. Yeah, he's like the first guy. yeah, I felt like Jack should have like grabbed him by the shoulders and said thank you. Yeah, I do, you know, again, I do have to love how much this show sort of unwittingly paints cops as just the dullest knives in the drawer, totally incompetent. It's pretty great.
Here I talked about the scene where Kim is put into the holding cell and she's clearly afraid of some of the other people in the cell.
Oh my gosh. That honestly may be the most offensive scene in the show so far, next to the egregious like Terry scene. It was pretty disgusting. Like sort of meaningfully lingering on this like totally, you know, normal looking black woman. it was pretty bad. I gotta say, Kim deserves jail time, and I think it'll do her some good.
Here I talked about how the cop seems to automatically believe Melody.
Well, as every good detective knows, whoever you talk to first is telling the most truth, and then after that, the net amount of truth dwindles. How long, okay, if we were betting, how many episodes do you think Kim will sit in a jail cell just, like, waiting until the guy actually calls the number? Yeah, I'm sort of torn. I'm like, it's either going to happen in, like, the very first scene of the next episode where all of a sudden she's out and, like, there's no longer any tension there, or they're just going to leave her languishing there for, like, an episode or two because they don't know what to do with her.
Here I liken the scene in the jail cell to the finale of Seinfeld.
This is a moment where I wish I had like some facility with the kinds of programs that would allow you to do this, but you know, I would love to take those shots of Kim and just like start rolling the Seinfeld final credits over that. That would be great. Yeah, I was wondering about your take on that because I kind of felt that way a little bit too.
Here I talked about how it seemed that there was a marked shift in how they were writing Nina and how she seemed to be annoyed that she didn't know where Jack was and this sort of loss of information on her end.
Yeah, it could kind of go either way. And I think part of that too is they've just lost the writers have just totally lost a handle on what to do with her. It's very weird.
Here I talked about the scene where Mason effortlessly finesses Jack's phone away from him by pretending his battery's dead and consequently turning Jack's phone off.
He's an operator, man. He knows what he's doing. and I like to, as you know, I'm not the sort of person who would go in and write entries for the goofs section of IMDb pages. But the type of person who would, you know, has the keen eye to notice that shortly after that, you know, in the next episode, Mason's phone rings and Jack doesn't think anything of it. You know, I mean, I think to some degree, like, it's expected that the viewer is supposed to forget most everything between episodes, aside from the main stuff, but I did think that was pretty funny. But I do love the way that Mason handles all of that. That's such a great, great little sleight of hand. I love, since you brought up the Palmers, I love in episode 19, the opening scene with them, that, like, awkward dinner scene. It's so good. Like, just like, I mean, it starts to do the 24 thing where, like, all of a sudden everything gets turned up to 11. But, like, the moment of just, like, awkward silence around that table, because I think it's the first time the whole family's been together for quite a few episodes in that way. Yeah. And it's just like, it's like, man, a lot of stuff has gone down in the last 20 hours.
Here I talked about how I felt it was the best Palmer episode yet.
Yeah, except that he inexplicably gives like a 25-minute speech. Yeah. It's like, what else is he talking about?
Here's where I talked about how I felt that the Palmers had more believability as a family, simply because we actually got more time with them as opposed to the Bowers.
Yeah, like, this is not a completely typical day for the Palmers, but they're still able to do a lot of things that they would do every day. And I think those things are just oftentimes better at revealing these kind of dynamics. Like, we really have only had that very first scene of the whole show where the Bowers are together, which I think is why they felt so disconnected, is because we don't really have any sense of how these people are relating to each other, except in the most, like, generic way. But the Palmers, and I mean, the Palmer stuff is so interesting too, because of course, like, and again, Dennis Haysbert, Penny Johnson, Gerald are just really bringing their A game these episodes, and like seeing the revelation in Haysbert's eyes when, you know, he really realizes that, like, this person whom I loved and who loved me, like, something happened somewhere along the way, and, like, she just wants power, right? Like, that's, it's such a great moment. And, like, you know, the way that Penny Johnson Gerald is just able to, like, flip this switch, you know, between these modes is really, she's, like, very exacting. And it plays well, I think, against Palmer's kind of, like, somewhat naive kind of nature. But the show kind of sides with him too, because then we get the polls that are like, hey, actually no one cared about this. Which is, like, it's sort of interesting because, you know, it's presented here as like a good thing, like, oh, you know, the voters value honesty and value this and that. But it also sort of retrospectively reads as like an early sign of, you know, the cynicism of the American electorate, just kind of being like, well, everybody's got skeletons, baby. Like, doesn't matter. What's so wild about that to me is, like, honestly, you know, let me make it clear. Dianne Feinstein is an evil person. But at this point, I mean, truly, honestly, I feel bad. Like, this is elder abuse at this point, you know. So, like, all other stuff is off the table. But I do think...
He implicitly extended that to our current president.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, where, you know, the gerontocracy is... it'll be interesting to see what happens in 10 years, if they ever die, if they ever allow themselves to die. But I do think what's interesting, actually running off that point, it's sort of interesting that here we see, like, we don't see this reliance on the staff, right? Like, as, like, it is the Palmers, and, like, sort of unbeknownst to Haysbert's character, you know, his wife has been doing these things kind of in the background to secure his candidacy. And then also, like, you know, there was the shadowy cabal of businessmen that I foolishly trusted to have the best interests of the country at heart. It's so good. Yeah. And you get to see Carl with these, you know, kind of like, you know, these men in these back rooms. And
here I compared one of the men to Angelo Badalamenti and Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, and it does, you know, another thing that happens in these episodes too is that it really it really shows its colors. It's like an LA story, right? Because we finally realize that like the plot is partially, at least like the plot in these episodes, is about like water and real estate, right? Like, why is this a preserve? There's no water here. Why would this large plot of land, you know, have this like electrical grid that needs to be shut down? Like, it's very, I really appreciated that. Even 24 has to come back to the fundamentals of, you know, LA storytelling. Yeah.
Here I brought up Tom Anderson's point in Los Angeles Place itself, that the real Chinatown essentially played out in the newspapers and that the public voted overwhelmingly for the development.
Yeah, it has, you know, it has the slightest shades of Thomas Pynchon here too. The kind of wandering around, and you know, he ends up finding the stairwell, and this leads, you know, you've been alluding for a little while to a big casting reveal, and I was just thrilled when I saw that you were talking about Lou Diamond Phillips, one of my favorite. He's great. It's a delight to see him when he shows up on screen. He really deserves bigger roles. Of course, this is a reunion between him and Kiefer from the Young Guns films. I thought it was great. yeah, he's fantastic. No, but of course I'm talking about the reveal of Dennis Hopper. Which I have no idea how I forgot this. I think it's probably because the last time I watched this, Dennis Hopper meant nothing to me. So, you know, my, you know, rat brain had not crawled back along those neuronal connections to backfill, my adolescent self watching the show. But he does the most ridiculous accent, and I was so excited by it. He goes for it. He doesn't get a lot of lines here either, but when he does, he's really digging in.
Here I talked about how it seemed that they were purposely bringing in Dennis Hopper as this sort of icon of New Hollywood, of Easy Rider, and this sort of seeming desire to ensure the legitimacy of 24 by bringing in a movie actor, even one who was sort of in his character actor days at this point.
This has got to be, at the point that this came out, that's probably the biggest movie to TV slide, right? I mean, of course he's not playing like a major role here, but I mean, it's a, like the casting is meant to, you know, immediately sort of give us an impression of the importance of this character through like someone that's iconic and recognizable. But I was trying to think like, well, who else might have been this big that, you know, had a part as significant as this on a television show? And this might be the first real big one that wasn't, you know, maybe like a cameo in a sitcom or something like that might be. Another thing I like about this is that it for sure establishes that there is only one degree of, there's only one degree that separates Kiefer from Orson Welles.
Here I wondered about the possibility of Kiefer meeting Orson Welles in person.
Let me do a fact check on that, because I don't want to, okay, 85, yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's any way they ever met. If I ever get to ask Kiefer Sutherland one question, that will be the question, is did you ever meet Orson Welles? It's like right on. I mean, the only other chance I think might be just being like a Hollywood kid for a little while. So that's like probably the best bet. Let's see. Okay, Start the Revolution Without Me, a 1970 American period comedy film directed by Bud Yorkin. It starred Gene Wilder and Donald Sutherland, and Orson Welles was in it, but he was the narrator, so I don't know. Having not seen the movie, my guess is that Orson was just in a sound studio recording and not actually in it. Yeah, I'll have to do more research there. Maybe at the premiere or something, possibly. But that would have been, you know, that's 1970. Kiefer would have been fairly young, right? Yeah, he would have been like 4 or 5 years old, depending on when. Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. So maybe child Kiefer did meet Orson, but we know for sure both through potentially through his dad and definitely through Dennis Hopper. He's 1 degree of separation away. I do want to say too, because I cut you off earlier, but I do want to say that I do legitimately love Lou Diamond Phillips in this role. He's really, really good.
Here I liken the underground sort of military prison scenes to Day of the Dead or Assault on Precinct 13, since I had watched it recently.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's so great because these two episodes have some, like, I mean, it's a little bit of a stretch in the first episode, but there's like some genre play going on here, right? Once again, you know, 24 is a little bit of a Western. You know, I wrote specifically two notes. 24 is a Western, parentheses, barbed wire, and then 24 is a Western, parentheses, sunset. But then also you get this like great like noir, neo-noir vibe of looking for this. And then, of course, when Hopkins comes back in, I mean, that stairwell sequence is, I mean, that's a horror film. That's like, it's so great. And you can tell like he's bringing, you know, his experience and expertise to bear on just the way it's shot, the way it's cut. It's just excellent. I think it's almost like a flashbang type thing. And then, I mean, from what I've read about them, they are extremely disorienting. And then, yeah. And then whatever the noise is, I would guess, you know, that like, one of the problems with translating that noise is that you want it to be like, you want it to sound harsh to the viewer, but you also don't want it to, you know, inflict pain. Maybe they were giving him Havana syndrome, the use of sonic weaponry here. If you're down in that bunker long enough, you'll definitely get a case of Havana syndrome. That's for sure. Yeah. But that's a great sequence. It was just tops.
Yarak talked about how it seemed out of character for Andre to want to go in, even though it seemed likely that his troops would be cut down, but how it was totally in character that he would not be fazed by his brother's possible death at all.
But also, I love that it's just like, okay, our elaborate plan of paying off this utility worker to do this thing for us has backfired. Let me real quick Google where the closest transformer is so we can blow it. It's like, why wasn't this the plan to begin with if it was that easy, you know? I mean, apparently. I guess it's sort of like, it's none of your business what we do with them once we have them. Like, maybe that's kind of the, it's strictly need to know. I mean, Lou Diamond Phillips' character doesn't even really, like, know, you know, who the guy is, what he's there for. Like, he's not privy to that information either. I'd be remiss here not to mention as well that Lou Diamond Phillips' character, Mark DeSalvo, was named that way through a Fox charity auction benefiting the victims of 9/11. And the real Mark DeSalvo bid $10,000 to name the character after himself.
Here I pointed out how the price for naming a 24 character must have skyrocketed in later seasons.
Yeah, this definitely feels like, you know, the 2002 charity auction. This is like, you know, this is like what your average like jet ski dealer is going to be bidding on. Whereas in a couple years, it would definitely be like a big ticket item, you know, name a character in 24.
Here I pointed out the elaborate sort of mini camp setup that the Drazens have and how it seems improbable that Jack wouldn't have spotted it.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting that he didn't just stumble on them at some point. Yeah. I mean, I guess the most charitable reading there is that they're close to the prison stairwell. And Jack doesn't get there until it's dark out. So I suppose, you know, it's sort of interesting. Yeah, I mean, the whole way the revelation comes out about, like, it's really, because I think we sort of have already talked about this, what's really a plot twist in the show, but which we knew going in, you know, that he's not dead. It's interesting the way that it kind of builds up to this moment where there's going to be this assault on the prison, because we don't get it. And now at the end of this episode, you know, that great line reading of Hopper, what does he say? He's like, they're here. it's really fantastic. Oh yeah, is he like following the wire from the security camera? Is that what he's doing while he's on the phone? Yeah. And it's just like, oh yeah, they got their security room. I just walk right in. Yeah, C5 is really advanced Serbian explosive technology. It hasn't made its way to the West yet.
Here I talked about Jack not knowing the existence of such prisons.
And the same thing with Palmer, right? I think like one of the things that these episodes demonstrate really in a really interesting way is like, you know, these are our protagonists in a way, but they're also, despite their positions, are really removed from where the real decisions are happening, right? The fact, you know, for instance, that Jack was the only one who survived, right? And which he saw maybe as like, you know, potentially a, you know, a sacrifice and one that's obviously haunted him, but one that at the end he felt, you know, we accomplished our mission, we did what we needed to do, we got rid of this really dangerous guy. Now, of course, it comes out that all of this, you know, is not, you know, merely revenge. It is revenge, but it's also that, you know, these people that were trying to kill him knew more about what was going on than he did, right? Yeah, high profile, yeah. Well, and it also goes back to, you know, they've made a lot of, like, this is the day where Jack Bauer and David Palmer will be in L.A. At the same time. And it also just so happens that on the same day, our father will also be in L.A., yeah, you know, there's a, you know, every good plan requires a bit of luck.
Here I talked about how the Kim stuff is used as the sort of concluding scene before the ad breaks on at least two occasions.
Oh, yeah. It's really given pride of place. At least they sort of have the dignity to kind of hide the Terry stuff and the interstitials, and then, like, you know, at least give us some payoff with the Tony stuff. I really don't know where this Kim plot is gonna, I feel like it's just gonna kind of fizzle out.
Here I speculated about the possibility of Gaines deciding to spice up his plan by getting Jack framed for Palmer's death, even though that didn't seem to be part of the Drazen's plan.
You know, that, you know, I kind of wonder, I can and maybe not, but in my head at least, that's what happened, because he seems like the kind of guy who's like, he's a little ambitious. He doesn't want to just be like a middle manager henchman. He wants to be the guy at the top calling the shots, and he brings a certain flair to what he does. You know, he's got some pride in it. So, you know, it's not just simple enough to kill these two guys. He's got to like do it in style. You know, he overcomplicates it though. And that really, that's his undoing. There is this great moment. It was a little too long to write down for a quote, but it happens in episode 20, the kind of confrontation scene between the Palmers. There's this great line, and of course, Penny Johnson Gerald gives this great reading of it, about, like, she's, like, talking to Palmer, and she says something like, you know, do you think the American people want a president who's, like, a guest on a bad afternoon talk show, like confessing his sins? It was so like, it was both great, because it's just like such a knife to the heart kind of line. Like, she really has contempt for what she sees as his just like hopeless naivete, right? But then also, I mean, you know, again, sort of a premonition of, you know, the political landscape of the last 20 years, where it's like, pretty clear that there is actually a significant portion of the electorate that just kind of wants a guy up there to say, well, you know, we drone some folks, right? I thought it was just like, yeah, both worked in this moment with these characters as just like, oh, wow, she really hates him, right? But was also, again, like, you know, doing that thing where the show is maybe quite unconsciously, you know, the kind of bubbling up of the culture and the, you know, our political economy of the past couple decades it's in here, right? Like it's emergent. So I thought it was just another interesting moment in the show that worked on those like dual levels.
Here I mentioned how Palmer today would write his apology in a notes app.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That would be really great. If they bring 24 back, which I feel like is inevitable. Yeah. Well, I feel also like, you know, maybe it'll definitely have been long enough that like, you know, maybe Jack has like a grandson or granddaughter who is like a TikTok celebrity or something. I both dread and eagerly await when they finally decide to bring this back for some kind of ill-conceived, you know, limited run series or something.
Here I mentioned a Hopkins shot where Sherry closes the door and Palmer is still sitting there in the reflection.
Yeah, like sitting on the bed, I think. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And there's in the previous episode, I think it is. Yeah, it's in the previous episode. There's kind of a cool moment where Terry is sitting in the living room. And we get like a split screen of like kind of a medium shot of her sitting and then this very close eyeline shot. And the way that they're like mismatched a little bit is sort of interesting. Just kind of a nice touch. That's outside of, you know, that's not the Hopkins episode, but it's one of those rare moments outside of his episodes that I feel like these directors are like exploring the possibilities of this convention that's been established. So yeah, this is just a great, great couple episodes. Well, you know, I mean, this is the, yeah. Yeah, when the show's really working at one level, it kind of subordinates the problems at the other levels, you know. Yeah. Yeah, this show really needs things to happen. And as long as things are happening, even if they're bad, generally, you know, if you can get some good stuff mixed in there, it's worth watching, so. Yeah. Yeah, the first... We're approaching the end of the Outer Ring of Hell.
Here I remarked how the show has 9 seasons to match the 9 rings of hell in Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It really is. It really is perfect.
Here I remarked about our now 3-week break and our continued descent into limbo.
Yeah, your twin Virgils will return.